of all these windows to the past, this window, and only this very unique window, will show you a priceless gem, a gift from Baha'u'llah. His most precious gift to mankind was his revelation. The second was Abdul Baha, the mystery of God, whose mystery no mortal tongue can ever disclose. Abdul Baha walked on this earth as an extraordinary man and a successor to Baha'u'llah, but he was more than a man leading and guarding the cause of his father. He was not a manifestation of God, but indeed he was the repository of the revelation of Baha'u'llah. A moon in the orb of Baha'i dispensation, receiving its light from Baha'u'llah. And in the guardian's words, a perfect mirror, reflecting the light of Baha'u'llah. His station had been prophesied in the holy books of the past, and the spiritual intuition of that immortal heroine Tahire enabled her to recognize his station when he was about 5 years old. When she was entertaining him in the house of Baha'u'llah, the erudite and distinguished Wahid had come to see her, but was kept waiting in the reception room. Someone told her, "Maybe you should not keep Wahid waiting any longer." She turned to the young child and said, "Shall I leave you, the protector of the cause, to go and visit a follower of the cause?" What an insight! Abdul Baha's relationship to Baha'u'llah was not that of an ordinary son and father. He truly recognized the supreme station of Baha'u'llah, and on Abdul Baha's begging, Baha'u'llah granted him the bounty of servitude, the greatest attribute in the sight of God. In that, he became as lowly as offering himself as dust in the pathway of his loved ones, and thus achieved the highest station. Doesn't the lowest valley collect the water flowing from the summit of a lofty mountain? So did he become the repository of the revelation of Baha'u'llah, and after Baha'u'llah's ascension, the fountainhead of the spiritual energies released by Baha'u'llah. To enable you to ponder on Abdul Baha's station and his spiritual powers, it suffices to refer to the words of Baha'u'llah when, 1 year before his ascension, he addressed the martyr poet, hand of the cause, Varga in Akka. Baha'u'llah said, "There is a phenomenon in this world. Those who possess it can exert such influence on the world which goes beyond their mortal life." In some of his tablets, Baha'u'llah has referred to this phenomenon as the most great elixir. Then he told Varga, "Jesus was blessed with that power, and so is the Master." Varga, being overjoyed, prostrated himself at the feet of Baha'u'llah and begged that he and one of his sons be accepted as a sacrifice in the path of Abdul Baha. His wish was granted. During the ministry of Abdul Baha, he and his 12-year-old son, Ruhullah, attained the crown of martyrdom. Abdul Baha was born in Tehran, Iran, on May 23, 1844, the day of the declaration of the Bab. His given name was Abbas, but in spite of many exalted titles conferred upon him by Baha'u'llah, after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, he chose the title of Abdul Baha, meaning the servant of Baha. His first title was the Master, or Agha, and shortly after, the Mystery of God, or Sirrullah, which was conferred upon him by Baha'u'llah early in the Baghdad years. Later on, the titles of Man Tawfa Hawlahu al-Asma', meaning he around whom all names revolve, and Ghusn-e-Azam, or the most great branch, were given by Baha'u'llah. The designation of exemplar used by the believers is from the writings of Shoghi Effendi, who stated, Abdu'l-Bahá was the perfect exemplar of Baha'u'llah's faith and endowed with superhuman knowledge. He was the eldest child of Baha'u'llah, but not the firstborn. In his talk, Abdu'l-Bahá has stated that when a child, possibly 6 years old, he sat on the lap of Tawhiri, when from behind the curtain, as was customary those days, she addressed the erudite Wahid, encouraging him to show his faith with his action, and that he did valiantly until his martyrdom. When he was 7 years old, he became seriously ill with tuberculosis and was not expected to live. Because of this, he could not go to their summer home in Mazandaran in the summer of 1852. As we recall, it was in August of 1852 when Baha'u'llah was thrown in the Siyahchal of Tehran. Abdu'l-Bahá stated, afterward, the wisdom for this became evident. Were it not for that illness, I would have been in Mazandaran, but I remained in Tehran and was there when the Blessed Perfection was imprisoned. Thus I traveled to Iraq in his company, and when the time came, although physicians had despaired of my recovery, I was suddenly cured. In that summer of 1852, due to attempt on the life of the Shah by crazy Babis, Baha'u'llah was arrested and taken in chains to the Siyahchal, or the Black Pit. Their mansion was ransacked. They also were shunned by their relatives, being afraid for their own safety. Abdu'l-Bahá was barely 9 years old. His younger sister, Bahiyyah Khanum, or the greatest holy leaf, was 7, and the youngest brother, Mirza Mehdi, or the purest branch, was 5. Only the faithful servant Esfandiyar courageously stayed and helped them. His mother of Siyah Khanum rented a very small apartment near the dungeon. All of a sudden they went from riches to rags. Being short of food, one day his mother gave him a handful of dry flour to ease his hunger. At times, Abdu'l-Bahá was sent by his mother to sympathetic relatives to borrow money. Rowdy children, knowing the situation, used to chase and pelt him, calling him names. One day he decided it was enough of that. So, while being chased, he suddenly stopped and began to run towards them. This startled them, and seized with fear, they ran away and never bothered him again. He was so anxious to see his father. He begged his mother over and over until she permitted. He was taken to the dark and stench-filled dungeon by Esfandiyar. On the shoulder of the servant, as they climbed down a few steps, Baha'u'llah saw him and ordered them to take him away at once. So they waited at the prison courtyard for the time that the prisoners were brought out for walking in fresh air. As soon as his eyes fell on Baha'u'llah's unkempt appearance, chained to others, barely able to walk, he fainted and was taken home. How could he ever erase that gruesome memory from his mind? It was all too much for that barely 9 years old boy. First to hear the news of his father's arrest, and how on that hot summer day his shoes and hat were removed, and he was walked for hours in chains to the dungeon. How he was mocked and pelted by the onlookers, and now, actually seeing and smelling the dungeon and what it had done to his once majestic father. In December, after 4 months, the good news of Baha'u'llah's pending release arrived. This was a relief, since the rest of the prominent Babi leaders had been brutally put to death. However, with the news came the edict of their exile to Iraq in the dead of winter. The family began their journey in January 1853, after Baha'u'llah had somewhat recovered from deadly typhoid fever and leech wounds. With inadequate provisions, the journey began on foot and some pack mules. They had to go over the ice-covered and snow-bound mountain passes of western Iran on their way to Baghdad. Sometimes, facing blizzards, they had to go on narrow trails on the edge of steep mountainsides. Often Abdu'l-Bahá was carried on the shoulders of his uncle Mirza Musa, the faithful brother of Baha'u'llah. Two of Baha'u'llah's faithful brothers went with them. One was Mirza Musa, the full brother, and the other Mirza Muhammad Ghuli, a half-brother. Mirza Yahya, the timid half-brother of Baha'u'llah, went into hiding and later joined them in Baghdad. Abdu'l-Bahá's blessed and tender feet froze on that trip and caused him pain for the rest of his life. The younger brother, Mirza Mehdi, only 5 years old, had to be left behind with relatives because he was too young for the rigors of that harsh journey. He was separated for 7 years. Abdu'l-Bahá's mother, who was pregnant, had to cook and wash. Her delicate hands were so badly chapped. Abdu'l-Bahá witnessed it all. Moses was alone when he was cast out of Egypt. Baha'u'llah was ill and had his family with him, nevertheless. Both had to withstand the hardship beyond endurance of ordinary men. Baha'u'llah suffered more, seeing what his loved ones had to go through. Finally, they arrived in Baghdad in April of 1853. Although Abdu'l-Bahá was only 9 years old, he had such spiritual power that intuitively he recognized the station of his father, and thus he was the first to discover his true station. Abdu'l-Bahá prostrated at the feet of Baha'u'llah and implored for the privilege of laying down his life in his path. Baha'u'llah granted that he become the servant of the cause. You see, the most pleasing thing in the sight of God is service. As the opposite poles of the magnet are attracted to each other, humility and servitude are the only attributes man can achieve, which are the opposite of the attributes of majesty and sovereignty of God. All the other attributes which man could strive for are possessed by God in absolute perfection. Although Baha'u'llah had alluded to his disappearance, no one understood its meaning. It was 1 year after their arrival in Baghdad when one morning the household of Baha'u'llah woke up to find him gone. He had taken a servant and very little provisions. No one knew his whereabouts. His departure was because of the disunity his half-brother Mirza Yahya was causing. While Yahya wanted to be close to Baha'u'llah, yet he claimed that Baha'u'llah was interfering with the Babi's recognition of him. So Baha'u'llah gave him the opportunity to prove himself. So inept and rejected he felt that when Baha'u'llah's whereabouts was discovered, he sent a letter requesting Baha'u'llah's return. Baha'u'llah's sudden departure for an unknown location was hard to bear. Abdu'l-Bahá, now about 10 years old, suffered the most, because not only Baha'u'llah was his father, he was his lord. He stated that in those 2 years he grew old. The family had no idea about his whereabouts until, through various informations reaching Baghdad about a holy man named Darwish Muhammad Irani, that was the name Baha'u'llah assumed during those 2 years, in the mountains of Sulaymaniyeh, they learned about his location. Abdu'l-Bahá, now 12 years old, and Baha'u'llah's full brother Mirza Musa dispatched 2 believers to beg Baha'u'llah to return, which he accepted. Mirza Yahya was about 24 years old and was conducting the affairs of the family and the believers. He had locked himself in the house, fearing danger, but conducted the affairs by correspondence. He had such fear that when the youngest child of Baha'u'llah, about 1 year old, became ill, he refused to permit a physician or even any neighbor to come for help. When the little boy died, Mirza Yahya did not allow the family to have anybody come and prepare his body for burial. The body was given to a stranger who took it away. What a heartbreak for Abdu'l-Bahá's mother. During those 2 years, Abdu'l-Bahá occupied his time with reading whatever of the Bab's writings that he could find. What a joy and joyful moment when expectantly they heard the footsteps of Baha'u'llah and saw him appear at the door in the garb of a dervish. How touching was Abdu'l-Bahá's embrace of his father, not letting go of him. In a few years, the extraordinary nature of Abdu'l-Bahá became manifest to foe and friend. A learned nobleman, Ali Shaukat Pasha, requested that Baha'u'llah reveal a commentary of this sentence from Islamic tradition ascribed to Muhammad, quote, "I was a hidden treasure. I wish to be made known, and thus I call creation into being in order that I might be known," end of quote. Baha'u'llah delegated this response to Abdu'l-Bahá only in teenager, without any schooling. Abdu'l-Bahá's commentary revealed his profound knowledge, mastery of the language, and rare qualities of mind, filling the recipient with awe and admiration. An enemy of Baha'u'llah once remarked that if Baha'u'llah had no other proof to substantiate his exceptional powers, raising a son such as Abdu'l-Bahá would have been sufficient. On that April day in 1863, when Baha'u'llah left his house in Baghdad for the last time, as he crossed the river in a boat to enter the garden of Rizwan, the boat also carried Abdu'l-Bahá, then 18, Mirza Mehdi, 14, and Muhammad Ali, their half-brother, 10 years old. In the course of 4 months of their travel to Istanbul, with a caravan of 72 companions, Abdu'l-Bahá rode a horse alongside his father. What a majestic sight! He oversaw the progress of the journey. Provisions for that many people and animals and arrangements for their stopping places were all his responsibilities. The 5 years in Adrianople saw the rise of Baha'u'llah's ministry to its zenith, and also witnessed the depth of Mirza Yahya's evil deeds. In those years, Khurshid Pasha became the governor of Adrianople, and his deputy Aziz Pasha recognized Abdul Baha's greatness. He constantly sought companionship of Abdul Baha, who was then about 23 years old. Later on, we will hear about this man again. How distressed was Abdul Baha to see Baha'u'llah poisoned almost fatally by Mirza Yahya, and to hear Dr. Shishman, who attended him at home, to pronounce his condition hopeless. The doctor fell at Baha'u'llah's feet and without prescribing any remedy left. In a few days, the doctor became ill. When Baha'u'llah's secretary, Mirza Agha Jan, visited him, he said that God had answered his prayers. Baha'u'llah's illness lasted about a month. He stated that Dr. Shishman had sacrificed his life for him. Baha'u'llah, who had excellent penmanship, rarely took the pen after that poisoning due to shaking of his hands. Among his writings after the poisoning are his letters to Abdul Baha and his will. In years to follow, how heartbreaking was for Abdul Baha to receive letters from his father and, seeing evidence of his shaking hand, remember those critical days. You can imagine what it was to watch the depraved acts of the desperate Mirza Yahya. If it was not poisoning of the well, which provided water for the family and believers, it was instructing their mutual barber, who was a believer, to kill Baha'u'llah while in bath. As mentioned earlier, Abdul Baha wished to shield Baha'u'llah, but some of the darts passed by him, yet the hand of Providence protected Baha'u'llah. Then came the most great separation between Baha'u'llah's followers and a few who followed Mirza Yahya, soon to be followed by their exile to Akka. Abdul Baha was 24 years old when he accompanied his father in exile to Akka. His youthful portrait is the passport photo taken for that trip, when the only photographic portrait of Baha'u'llah was also taken. In the barracks of Akka, where Baha'u'llah was confined in a solitary cell, the rest of nearly 70 companions were placed in crowded spaces. It was at first a strict decree by the government, but these harsh measures did not last long. At the beginning, Abdul Baha, noticing the crowded situation, chose to sleep in the room that formerly had been used as a morgue. Many believers became ill and a few died. For 4 months, Abdul Baha personally supervised their care and diet and made sure those believers in charge of shopping would not bring anything contaminated. Even he inspected their pockets. Then Abdul Baha fell ill himself, but miraculously recovered in spite of his having had childhood tuberculosis. Abdul Baha was instrumental in Badi meeting Baha'u'llah in his cell to be transformed, and by taking the message of Baha'u'llah to the king of Persia, attained the glory of becoming the pride of martyrs, or Fakhru Shuhada. Then, on that June 22, 1870, 2 months short of 2 years since their arrival in Akka, a tragedy struck. The 22-year-old Mirza Mehdi, the purest branch, while pacing on the prison roof in deep prayer, fell through an open skylight and fatally injured his chest. Members of the family and some believers, grief-stricken, gathered around him. Abdu'l-Bahá, with tearful eyes, entered the presence of Baha'u'lláh, prostrated, and begged for healing. Baha'u'lláh stated, "O my greatest branch, leave him in the hands of his God." You see, earlier, in the first few months in the barracks, when disease struck, a physician was brought at the bedside of one of the dying believers. When he arrived, after checking the pulse, he angrily protested, being called to examine a dead man. He exclaimed, "I am not Christ," and left. On Baha'u'llah's instruction, a healing prayer was read and the believer came back to life. Doesn't it speak for itself? Abdu'l-Bahá, being aware of the power of the Holy Spirit within Baha'u'llah, begged his father to heal Mirza Mehdi. Baha'u'llah went to the bedside of his injured son and dismissed everyone. It is stated that Baha'u'llah, having the power of life and death in his hands, asked his dying son what his wish was. He assured him that if he wished to live, God would make him recover and grant him a good health. But the purest branch begged his father and his Lord to accept his life as a ransom for opening the gates of the prison to many believers who longed to attain presence of Baha'u'llah. His wish was granted. 22 hours after his fall, he took his last breath. He was 12 years old when, after 7 years of separation, he was sent to his parents in exile in Baghdad. And now, this tragic separation broke his mother's heart, who wept constantly, until Baha'u'llah consoled her about the effects of his death. 4 months later, the restrictions were relaxed. The prisoners were placed in houses within the walled city because the government needed the barracks for military purposes. After living in a few houses for a short time, the large family of Baha'u'llah settled into the house of Udi Khammar. It was so crowded there that in one room, 13 persons of both sexes had to live. Of course, with the bad publicity about the prisoners, people were not friendly to them. Matter of fact, when Udi Khammar moved to his large mansion, which later became Baha'u'llah's mansion, as known as the Mansion of Bahji, and rented his own house in town to Baha'u'llah, it displeased his nephew Aboud. Both of them were Christians. Aboud, who lived next door, was a nephew and partner of Udi Khammar. Aboud was so upset that he wanted to prevent the transaction. Then, a shameful event made Aboud feel justified in his fear. It was shortly after they moved to that house when 3 followers of Mirza Yahya were killed by 7 followers of Baha'u'llah. These had been sent with Baha'u'llah to Akka by the order of the government for making mischief. One of their activities was constantly reporting to the authorities the arrival of any follower so they could be expelled before being able to see Baha'u'llah. One such follower was the historian Nabil-e-Azam, who had to live in a cave in Haifa. Baha'u'llah, foreseeing their action, had admonished his followers to be forbearing and patient, but to no avail. Abdul Baha was always so vigilant about shielding his father, but he had too many fronts to cover. This time the darts which bypassed him were from the friends. Baha'u'llah in that regard stated, "My captivity cannot harm me. That which can harm me is the conduct of those who love me, who claim to be related to me, and yet perpetrate what causes my heart and my pen to moan." This horrible incident caused jailing of Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha, with Abdul Baha being chained. They spent 3 days in jail, but the perpetrators were imprisoned much longer. Of course, poor Aboud, being afraid for his safety, barricaded his house against any access from the house of Baha'u'llah. You can realize what this noble and holy family had to go through, now being considered dangerous by their neighbor. Abdul Baha, who represented the family, in no time won them all with his love and charming personality. It was not unusual for the people of Akka who had not seen Baha'u'llah to refer to Baha'u'llah as the father of Abbas Afandi, meaning Abdul Baha. Soon we will see that the antagonistic Aboud made 180 degrees change in his attitude. That is why so many times those two houses are referred to as the house of Aboud. Let us not lose track of time. Now we are in 1873, 5 years after their exile to Akka, and about 3 years since they left the barracks. That was a memorable year for that little house and the entire world. It was within the confines of that house, the house of Aboud, that the most holy book, or the Kitab-e Aqdas, was revealed in summer of that year, and also that house witnessed the wedding of Abdul Baha to Munira Khanum. Abdul Baha was 29 years old and she was 26. Munira Khanum's given name was Fatimah. She was born to a childless couple whom the Bab blessed while in Isfahan by giving them a portion of food from his plate. Baha'u'llah had intended to have his niece, Shahr Banu Khanum, the daughter of his older half-brother, who was a believer, become the wife of Abdul Baha. This was also the wish of Shahr Banu Khanum's father. It is interesting that when Baha'u'llah was in Baghdad and Abdul Baha was in his teens, this brother went to Baghdad and asked Baha'u'llah to bring about the wedding. However, this brother of Baha'u'llah died before Abdul Baha became older. Later on, when Baha'u'llah sent a believer to Tehran with a ring and Kashmir shawl, which was customary gift for asking for a woman's hand in marriage, the older half-sister and half-brother of Baha'u'llah, who were not believers and who had become the guardian of Shahr Banu Khanum, refused to let her go to marry Abdul Baha. She was given to the son of the prime minister instead. This forced marriage brought her intense grief and she died from tuberculosis. Baha'u'llah stated that he saw in his dream that the charming face of Shahrbanu Khanum became darker and darker and faded away, and then one with luminous face and luminous heart appeared to him, and he chose her for the master. Luminous is the translation of Munire. Now we go to Isfahan, the famous city in Iran, well known for the turquoise blue mosaic tiles decorating many beautiful domes. Unless you rather stay in drab Akka. Well, we are not going there to see the colorful mosaics, but to witness the divine mosaic work. In 1872, from Akka, Baha'u'llah sent a tablet to the King of Martyrs, then a famous merchant in Isfahan, stating, "We have considered you as related to us." This great believer could not figure out what Baha'u'llah was alluding to. A few months later, Sheikh Salman, the famous courier of Baha'u'llah, arrived in Isfahan and gave the glad tidings that Baha'u'llah had sent him to escort Fatemeh Khanum to Akka. Fatemeh Khanum was the cousin of the King of Martyrs. After they arrived in Akka, she stayed for 5 months at the home of Mirza Musa, Baha'u'llah's brother, and at times attained the presence of Baha'u'llah. Mirza Musa often used to bring her gifts from Baha'u'llah. You would guess that she was sure that she was chosen for Abdul Baha. The answer is maybe. Until one day when Mirza Musa told her the joyous news that Baha'u'llah had sent her the most wonderful gift, and that was the title of Munire, meaning luminous. She became overjoyed, having heard about Baha'u'llah's dream when he chose the luminous girl, or Munire, for Abdul Baha. Now we can say she was sure. Abu detected that the reason the wedding was not taking place was because of lack of room. So he opened a room from his house into Baha'u'llah's house and offered it for Abdul Baha, which Baha'u'llah accepted. Then the greatest holy leaf gave Munire Khanum a plain white dress and took her to the presence of Baha'u'llah, who told her, "O my leaf and my handmaiden, verily we chose thee and accepted thee to serve my most great branch. And this is by my grace which is not equaled by all the treasures of the earth and heaven." What a spiritual banquet. No earthly festivity could match it. In a short time, the unfriendly governor of Akka was replaced by Ahmad Beg Tawfiq, who sought Baha'u'llah's advice and had great respect for the cause. In 1875, Abdul Baha wrote his first book, which is The Secret of Divine Civilization. As we get closer to the end of Baha'u'llah's stay within the walled city of Akka, something unusual happened. No, it was not the dethronement of Sultan Abdul Aziz and his assassination. That had been foretold by Baha'u'llah when they were exiled to Akka. This was something extraordinary. After Sultan Abdul Aziz was killed, Sultan Abdul Hamid replaced him. The edict of Sultan was still in force about most strict imprisonment of Baha'u'llah and his family. Now listen to this. Do you remember earlier I told you we will hear more about Aziz Pasha, who was the deputy governor of Adrianople during Baha'u'llah's stay there? Well, now he has become the Wali, or the Governor General of Beirut. He made two separate trips to Akko to pay his respects to Baha'u'llah and see companionship of Abdu'l-Bahá, which he treasured so much. Then Medhat Pasha, the Prime Minister, invited Abdu'l-Bahá to Beirut. Who has heard of a Governor General to go and visit a prisoner? And then the Prime Minister of the realm invite the prisoner to be his guest. Abdu'l-Bahá, though considered a prisoner in Akka, without difficulty left for Beirut and was received honorably by the dignitaries. This was about 1878, when this liberal Prime Minister was in office. Being a reformer, unfortunately, he did not last too long in that office. It was during Abdu'l-Bahá's stay in Beirut when Baha'u'llah wrote to him in these words: "Praise be to him who had honored the land of Ba," meaning Beirut, "through the presence of him round whom all names revolve." And further he states, "Blessed, doubly blessed is the ground which his footsteps have trodden." Then Baha'u'llah finishes the letter by saying, "We beseech God, blessed and exalted be he, that he may honor us with meeting him soon." You can see the love relationship between the Lord and his servant and vice versa. Sovereignty and humility are the opposite poles and attract each other. As was mentioned before, their relationship was not that of a father and son with its usual and casual intimacy. When at home, Abdu'l-Bahá never entered the presence of Baha'u'llah without permission. The half-brothers of Abdu'l-Bahá, who were blind to the station of Baha'u'llah, treated Baha'u'llah as their respectable father, but not their lord. When, through allusions of Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l-Bahá sensed that the time was at hand for Baha'u'llah to leave the prison city of Akka, through the Mufti of Akka, he persuaded Baha'u'llah to leave the walled city for the country, namely the mansion of Mazra'i. Age-wise, Baha'u'llah was 60 years old and Abdu'l-Bahá 33. While in Mazra'i, Abdu'l-Bahá stayed in Akka, as he continued to do so even after Baha'u'llah had moved to the spacious mansion of Bahji. Abdu'l-Bahá negotiated rental, repair, and every requirement for Baha'u'llah's move, but he, his family, sister, and mother did not move to that mansion. The rest of the family moved to the mansion of Bahji and enjoyed the undeserved bounty of living so close to Baha'u'llah. Abdu'l-Bahá used to walk or ride on donkey between Akka and the mansion. When riding, as soon as the mansion came into view, like in a mile or so, he would dismount and walk the rest of the way. A servant never goes to see his lord while riding. And Baha'u'llah would send the believers in attendance to go for a distance to welcome him. Then he would stand at the balcony and state to the women and children, "Look at the master. Look at the majesty of his walk." Then Abdu'l-Bahá would climb the stairs and prostrate at the feet of Baha'u'llah. No one has surpassed Abdu'l-Bahá in humility and servitude. 2 years before the ascension of Baha'u'llah, when Professor Edward G. Brown of Cambridge, England, was granted interviews with Baha'u'llah, he also wrote this about Abdul Baha, who then was 46 years old. Quote, "Seldom have I seen one whose appearance impressed me more. A tall, strongly built man holding himself straight as an arrow, with white turban and raiment, long black locks reaching almost to the shoulder, broad, powerful forehead indicating a strong intellect combined with an unswerving will, eyes keen as hawks, and strongly marked but pleasing features. Such were my first impressions of Abbas Effendi, the master, as he is called by the Babis." Here I wish to interject that for many years Baha'is were called Babis. I will repeat the last sentence. "Such were my first impressions of Abbas Effendi, the master, as he is called by the Babis." Subsequent conversation with him served to heighten the respect with which his appearance had from the first inspired me. One more eloquent of speech, more ready of argument, more apt of illustration, more intimately acquainted with the sacred books of the Jews, the Christians, and Mohammedans could, I should think, scarcely be found even amongst the eloquent, ready, and subtle race to which he belongs. The qualities combine with a bearing at once majestic and genial, made me cease to wonder at the influence and esteem which he enjoyed even beyond the circle of his father's followers. This descriptive pen portrait by Edward Brown ends with this final touch. About the greatness of this man and his power, no one who had seen him could entertain a doubt. What a powerful pen. You can almost see and feel the presence of Abdul Baha. I told you how Abdul Baha, when they lived together with Baha'u'llah in Akka, never went into his presence without permission. Now listen to this. Once at the presence of some believers, a younger half-brother of Abdul Baha came casually to Baha'u'llah and said, "The master wishes that we go to such a garden, can we?" He was referring to Muhammad Ali. Baha'u'llah said, "There is only one master. The rest have their names." As mentioned earlier, it was about 1 year before Baha'u'llah's ascension when he told Varga, the martyr poet, that Abdul Baha also was blessed with the power of the Holy Spirit. During his last illness, Baha'u'llah entrusted his will, written in his own handwriting, sealed in an envelope, to Abdul Baha. On May 29, 1892, Baha'u'llah ascended early in the morning. At dawn, Abdul Baha and his half-brother Muhammad Ali washed his body. Before washing, Muhammad Ali told Abdul Baha that the two cases containing personal items and writings of Baha'u'llah, which were close to bed, might get splashed and better be moved to another room. Abdul Baha, as you remember, was not living in the mansion of Bahji, but Muhammad Ali was. So Muhammad Ali moved the cases out. Shortly after the ascension, a believer came to Abdul Baha stating that he had been honored with a tablet by Baha'u'llah and asked if Abdul Baha could affix Baha'u'llah's seal on it. When Abdu'l-Bahá asked Muhammad Ali to bring the cases, he denied having any knowledge of them. How badly he wished he could find Baha'u'llah's will in order to alter it. 9 days after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, in the presence of 9 believers and the family members, the seal on Baha'u'llah's will was broken, and the will, which Baha'u'llah called Kitab-e Ahdi, or the Book of My Covenant, was read. In English, this book is referred to as Kitab-e Ahd. It clearly appointed Abdu'l-Bahá as the unquestionable successor to Baha'u'llah and the authorized interpreter of his words. On the same day in the afternoon, the will was read aloud to all the family members and believers who were in Akka. The one who read it was Majduddin, the son of Mirza Musa, the faithful brother of Baha'u'llah, who had passed away 5 years earlier. This man, Majduddin, who had married a sister of Muhammad Ali, became a covenant breaker, and with the half-brother of Abdu'l-Bahá, rose against the covenant. As Abdu'l-Bahá once told him, he lived long enough to see the glorious days of the Guardian, while paralyzed and without speech, exactly as predicted by Abdu'l-Bahá. He died in 1955, when more than 100 years old. His house was the last property occupied by the covenant breakers close to the mansion of Bahji, which was torn down by the Guardian. Muhammad Ali, the half-brother of Abdu'l-Bahá, 8 years younger than him, with full knowledge of the wishes of Baha'u'llah, broke the covenant and was announced by Abdu'l-Bahá as the arch-breaker of the covenant. He was so deceitful that even when Baha'u'llah was living, he altered some of his writings and had to be reprimanded and chastised by Baha'u'llah's own hand. For 4 years, Abdu'l-Bahá was patient with him and assured him that according to Baha'u'llah's will, he will be the next in line for successorship. But he arrogantly declared that there was no guarantee that he would outlive Abdu'l-Bahá, and he planned to usurp position from Abdu'l-Bahá exactly the way Umar usurped the successorship from Ali, the rightful successor to Muhammad. Imagine the arrogance. With various intrigues and promises, he drew all of the half-sisters and brothers of Abdu'l-Bahá, nearly 40 people, into his camp. His main cause was that Abdu'l-Bahá claimed to be a prophet, which was against Baha'u'llah's writings, that no manifestation shall appear before 1,000 years. What a curse Muhammad Ali brought upon himself and others. These unfortunate people, through their choice, transgressed and sinned against the Holy Spirit itself, and therefore their souls will not be forgiven by God to the end of time, which has no end. It is timely to mention how Baha'u'llah knew what was coming. In one of his tablets he reveals, quote, "My sorrow is not for myself, but for him who shall come after me in the shadow of my cause, with manifest and undoubted sovereignty, inasmuch as they will not welcome his appearance, will repudiate his signs, will dispute his sovereignty, will contend with him, and will betray his cause." End of quote. Baha'u'llah, in many of his tablets, had cursed the breakers of his covenant. Now all of the covenant breakers are in the mansion of Bahji, and Abdu'l-Bahá, his sister, the greatest holy leaf, Abdu'l-Bahá's wife, and four unmarried daughters, lived as before within the walled city of Akka. Abdu'l-Bahá's mother, Ausiya Khanum, had passed away 6 years before the ascension of Baha'u'llah. The only other male in Abdu'l-Bahá's household was the faithful half-brother of Baha'u'llah, Mirza Muhammad Quli. How unfortunate was Mirza Agha Jan, Baha'u'llah's secretary for 40 years, who chose to go into the camp of the covenant breakers. With all of the wealth he had accumulated through gifts which believers sent to Baha'u'llah, he became their financial support. The first group of the Western believers, including Phoebe Hearst and May Bowles, the mother of Amatul Baha Ruhiye Khanum, attained his presence in December of 1898. This group of 15 went to Akka in three successive parties, each one staying only for 3 days. As you recall, Baha'u'llah, before his ascension, while in Haifa, pointed out to Abdu'l-Bahá where the shrine of the Bab should be built. After his ascension, Abdu'l-Bahá purchased that specific parcel of land, and soon the covenant breakers informed the property owners of surrounding lots that their property would become very valuable to Abdu'l-Bahá, and should any of them decide to sell to Abdu'l-Bahá, the covenant breakers should be contacted first so they could outbid Abdu'l-Bahá. The piece of land for the shrine had no access to the road for getting the supplies and equipment there, and the owner of the needed lot was not willing to sell to Abdu'l-Bahá for any price. So, one night Abdu'l-Bahá stayed up all night reciting prayers by the Bab over and over. The next morning, the stubborn owner approached him and indicated his willingness to negotiate, but Abdu'l-Bahá would not show any interest. The owner felt very guilty, saying he had been a victim of the mischief of the covenant breakers. He kept bringing the price down and even offered to give it away free. Then Abdu'l-Bahá told his attendant to purchase it for a fair price. In 1899, the same year that the holy dust of the Bab was brought to the Holy Land, Abdu'l-Bahá laid with his own hands the cornerstone of the shrine. These covenant breakers did everything to make life miserable for Abdu'l-Bahá, his family, and the steadfast followers. In particular, Muhammad Ali was determined to cause Abdu'l-Bahá's execution or exile to a very remote place. Since they occupied the mansion of Bahji, any time Abdu'l-Bahá and the believers went to the shrine of Baha'u'llah, they would stand on the balcony and harass them. With repeated reports to the government, Muhammad Ali and his allies stated that Abdu'l-Bahá, with the help of the Westerners, was building a fortress on Mount Carmel to take over the government. You should know that during this period, Abdu'l-Bahá lived in Akka, but had a temporary residence and a guest house in Haifa, where he often visited and stayed for short periods. To bribe the officials against Abdu'l-Bahá, the covenant breakers gave some of the personal belongings of Baha'u'llah. One official who had such an item tried to tease Abdu'l-Bahá but soon he learned not to do it again. He had the prayer beads of Baha'u'llah in his hands, which Abdu'l-Bahá immediately recognized. What his intentions were, we don't know. If he wanted to make a fortune or just tease, God knows. He asked Abdu'l-Bahá, "How much do you think these beads are worth?" Abdu'l-Bahá stated, "It depends in whose hands they are." It was on a hot August night in 1901, when Abdu'l-Bahá, just having returned from Bahji, where he had celebrated the anniversary of the declaration of the Bab, was informed about the edict of the Sultan. The order was that Abdu'l-Bahá must stay strictly within the confines of the walled city of Akka, and in this process, the covenant breakers were also caught in their own web. They were ordered to move from the mansion of Bahji to Akka. Who else except Abdu'l-Bahá would intercede on their behalf to the government so they could stay in the mansion? They stabbed him with daggers. He balmed their wounds. They caused him agony. He brought them comfort. Yes, indeed, who else except the exemplar, the master? But this did not stop them. They became bolder and their intrigues became wilder. The reincarceration of Abdu'l-Bahá and strict confinement within the city of Akka lasted from 1901 to 1908. During those 7 years, the flow of pilgrims slowed down considerably and towards the end stopped due to the restrictions imposed upon Abdu'l-Bahá. While Abdu'l-Bahá was confined within the city of Akka, the construction of the shrine of the Bab was not interrupted. The covenant breakers, living comfortably in the mansion of Bahji, felt ever more at liberty to pursue their evil schemes by bribing the authorities and giving receptions. Their ultimate goal was total elimination of Abdu'l-Bahá and taking leadership of the cause for personal gain. As stated by Abdu'l-Bahá, his greatest suffering during those years was his inability and deprivation from visiting the shrine of Baha'u'llah. He continued his correspondence with the believers in the East and the West. Many so-called non-Baha'i friends in Akka kept their distance, worrying about their own status and position. The most descriptive book about those years is the Memoirs of 9 Years in Akka by Dr. Yunese Afrukhte, which hopefully will be translated into English. In those years to follow, Muhammad Ali even conspired to take Abdu'l-Bahá's life through assassins. Like his cousin Majduddin, Muhammad Ali also outlived Abdu'l-Bahá by 16 years, and with envy watched the establishment of the power of the covenant and ministry of the guardian. However, they caused great hardship for Abdu'l-Bahá. It is interesting that the youngest half-brother of Abdu'l-Bahá, Mirza Badi'ullah, who was in his mid-30s, decided to change camps and began to attend the meetings of the believers at the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá. He definitely had his eye on the successorship. Abdu'l-Bahá told him that he would accept his repentance and forgive him if he would write down all of the evil doings that were implemented by older brother Muhammad Ali and his allies. Badi'ullah did exactly as he was told, And by doing this, he left a clear record of their activities. Being forgiven by Abdu'l-Bahá, he began to feel the status of being a son of Baha'u'llah. Some believers went to the extreme of kissing his hand. Then, in one gathering, where Badi'u'llah was also present, Abdu'l-Bahá told the believers that everyone should take note of what he had to say. He stated that, in case of his passing away, the Universal House of Justice should be elected to conduct the affairs of the faith. Well, what do you think? It was a clear message to Badi'u'llah, who after a short time went back to his old camp because his hope of leadership after Abdu'l-Bahá was dashed. Abdu'l-Bahá's daily work of attending the sick and the poor was not interrupted for a moment. In those distressful days, he stayed up all night, way past midnight, keeping up his communications. He wrote as many as 90 letters per day. Now you know how there are between 26 to 27,000 letters from his pen. Early in winter of 1907, a few days before the arrival of the henchmen of the Sultan, Abdu'l-Bahá had a dream, which he shared it with the believers. He saw a ship cast its anchor near Akka, and from it flew a few birds which resembled sticks of dynamite. These sticks of dynamite came inland and circled around his head while he was standing amidst the multitude of frightened inhabitants. Then the dynamite returned back to the ship without ever exploding. The dreaded moment arrived. With the 4-member board of inquiry sent by the central government to complete their long stretch and off and on investigations. Upon their arrival, the governor of Akka, who was friendly towards Abdu'l-Bahá, was dismissed. The board also took over the telephone and telegraph office, the nerve center of communication to isolate Akka from any communication except for their own direct contact with the capital. Rumors of every kind were spread all over. Some said that Abdu'l-Bahá will be sent to the remote desert of Fizan in Libya, which meant no survival. The other said he would be thrown in the sea. And yet another group said he would be hanged on the gallows. You could imagine the joy of the covenant breakers and the despair of the believers. To fan the flames, the covenant breakers showed hospitality to the members of the board, while Abdu'l-Bahá, totally unperturbed, carried on his usual day-to-day schedule, including repair of his house, planting trees, and even storing fuel for winter. This surprised the inhabitants, who were sure his days were numbered. Somehow, I cannot put any suspense in this story, because we know that the forces of evil are always defeated. But do you think we could have convinced those believers with their hearts in their throats? For Abdu'l-Bahá, there was no problem. But his concern was the distress of the believers about the impending separation and possible execution. The telephone and telegraph office was sealed to the public, but no one could block Abdu'l-Bahá's channels. While the board was there, the Consul of Spain, whose relatives had the agency of an Italian steamship company, secretly came to Abdu'l-Bahá's house and said, he had dispatched a ship to the bay and under his order it was moving around to distract suspicion. He offered to take Abdu'l-Bahá to any port in the world. Abdu'l-Bahá told a few of the prominent believers to consult on this and report their conclusion to him. They unanimously suggested that Abdu'l-Bahá should accept the offer, which to you and I makes sense. Why should Abdu'l-Bahá, the center of the covenant of Baha'u'llah, the builder of the world order, jeopardize his life? Well, he really did not need their advice or your and my opinion. He wished to show frailty of human mind in relation to divine will. We are always tested in our faith in Baha'u'llah's power and invincibility of his cause. Let us pray for steadfastness. Crisis of Badasht and test of faith has been repeated over and over and is not over yet. He thanked them for their earnest conclusion and told them, "The Bab did not run away, and I shall not run away." The tension in those days was at its height, because the board had come to take Abdu'l-Bahá with them. The believers could not sleep. They kept vigil until the final day arrived. You can almost hear the pounding of their hearts and feel their shattered nerves. The board made its last inspection of the shrine of the Bab, which was still under construction. Seeing the underground vault left no doubt in their minds about the purpose of that unusual and solid construction. The believers along the shore kept their vigil and watched the movement of the ship in the bay as it left Haifa. Well, that was it. They were coming to Akka to take Abdu'l-Bahá. Now that the sun was setting, they could see the ship even better with its lights on. The ship began slowly to move back towards Akka, and this was the sure sign that Abdu'l-Bahá would be arrested at any moment. Meanwhile, Abdu'l-Bahá was calmly pacing in the courtyard of his house. All of a sudden, to great surprise of the believers, the ship changed its course and headed towards the open sea. Apparently, urgent news had come to the officials that a bomb had exploded near the carriage of Sultan Abdul-Hamid while he was returning from the mosque. With the gravity of such an attempt on the life of the Sultan, everything else was put on the back burner, and the officials were summoned to return at once to Istanbul. It did not take too long before the Sultan was forced to submit to the demand of the revolutionaries, and in the summer of 1908, the constitution was reinstated, and all the religious and political prisoners were freed. Then, on that Nowruz day of 1909, he laid with his own hands the sacred remains of the Bab and his companion martyr in the heart of Mount Carmel, at the shrine which, as stated by him, every brick of it was laid with the labor of love, and every inch of it was raised with tears of agony. At the final moment of that emotional event, he took off his turban, shoes, and cloak, and laid his blessed head on the corner of the casket, and cried so intensely that it made everyone there weep with him. With all the services that Abdu'l-Bahá rendered, he considered this one his greatest accomplishment. The same night, a telegram arrived about the formation of the first Baha'i National Convention of Delegates in Chicago. Within the course of 1 year, his household was gradually transferred to his newly built house in Haifa. At the age of 65, he left Akko forever, never to set foot within the city gates of Akko again. He was 24 years old when he entered Akko as a prisoner. With the gates opened, the flood of believers began to flow and his correspondence ever increased. It was not unusual that he simultaneously kept 3 secretaries writing separate letters in 3 languages, Persian, Arabic, and Turkish. Shoghi Effendi, his eldest grandson, at times acted as his secretary for correspondence in English. Abdu'l-Bahá slept and ate very little. His diet included bread, goat milk, cheese, tea, and olives. Many times at dinner tables he served the believers and the company himself. While some were spellbound by his presence, he would remind them to eat. At the evening of his life, at the age of 67, in 1911, he began his extensive journeys. First he went to Egypt, and on April 11, 1912, he arrived in New York on the steamship Cedric, having refused the reservation which dedicated believers had made on the maiden voyage of the luxurious Titanic. You can guess why. He covered many cities from coast to coast, speaking about the cause of Baha'u'llah in churches, synagogues, and universities. From lonesome imprisonment in the desolate Akko to the overcrowded lecture halls of the United States and Europe. If that animation is not from the power of Holy Spirit, what else could it be? He met politicians and scientists such as Theodore Roosevelt and Alexander Graham Bell. After meeting Lee McClung, the United States Treasurer, Julia Thompson asked McClung what was his impression of Abdu'l-Bahá. These are exact words of McClung. I seem to be in the presence of one of the great old prophets. Isaiah, Elijah, Moses. And yet, it was more than that. He was like Christ. No, now I have it. He seemed to me like my divine father. Abdu'l-Bahá laid the cornerstone of the House of Worship in Wilmette, Illinois, in May 1912. While in the United States, he made a side trip to Montreal, Canada. While on the West Coast, he visited the grave of Thornton Chase in Los Angeles, who had just died before his arrival in California. He returned to New York, the City of the Covenant, and on December 5th, 1912, he left New York by a steamship for Liverpool on his way to London. Then he visited a few European cities, such as Paris and Stuttgart, and the last leg of his extensive and historic journey was Egypt, where he spent about 5 months. He returned to the Holy Land on December 5th, 1913, at the eve of World War I, which he had predicted. His journey to the West and long absence from the Holy Land had 2 purposes. One was to raise the call of Yah Baha'ul Abha firsthand in the remote cities of the West, and the second was to show the world that the institution of the covenant was so firmly established that his half-brother, the Archbreaker, and his allies, in spite of his absence, had no power. He accomplished both missions to perfection. Before the onset of the World War, and after it began, he advised the believers to cultivate large fields of land and plant grain which was stored. When the famine struck, he gave grain to the needy. It was towards the end of that war when Jamal Pasha, the Turkish commander-in-chief and the bitter enemy of the faith, allied with Germans, expressed his intention to crucify Abdul Baha and level the shrine of Baha'ullah. However, through the efforts of the British believers, the Foreign Office advised General Allenby, the commander officer in that region, to extend all protection to Abdul Baha, which was done promptly and effectively. After the liberation of Palestine by the British forces, at a ceremony specially held for his sake in Haifa, General Allenby conferred the British knighthood upon Abdul Baha for his humanitarian services to the public during the famine in those gloomy days of war. Among other highlights of 29 years of his ministry were the erection of the first house of worship in Ashgabat in Russian Turkestan and repair of the house of the Bab in Shiraz. Abdul Baha's writings could be classified in these categories. Number 1, the Will and Testament, that unmatched document which established the administrative order and appointment of Shoghi Effendi as the guardian. Number 2, the books he wrote are 3. The Secret of Divine Civilization, written in 1875. A Traveler's Narrative, which is a brief history of the faith. Memorials of the Faithful, in which he honors number of outstanding early believers. The third category are the compilations of his talks and tablets under the following titles: Some Answered Questions by Laura Clifford Barney, which are his table talks in Akka during his reincarceration, Paris Talks, Promulgation of Universal Peace, which are his talks in the United States, the Tablets of the Divine Plan, which are 14 tablets written in 1916 and 1917, addressed to the Baha'is of the United States and Canada for the spiritual conquest of the planet. The last in this category is Selections from the Writings of Abdul Baha. The fourth category are his numerous letters to individuals in regard to explanations of Baha'ullah's writings and other matters. His mission fully accomplished the mystery of God, or as he wished it to be known, Abdul Baha ascended to the world of mysteries on November 28, 1921, in Haifa at the age of 77. His funeral, the like of which the Holy Land had never witnessed before, was attended by nearly 10,000 people from every class, color, and creed, as high as the High Commissioner of Palestine and as low as the beggars who received alms from his hands. all united as he wished them to be, mourn the loss of their beloved Abdu'l-Bahá. He was laid to rest in a vault, in a room adjacent to the room of resting place of the Bab, under the same shrine which he built so fervently with the labor of love and tears of agony. Messages of sympathy began to pour in from far and near. One was from no less a person than the British Secretary of State for Colonies, Mr. Winston Churchill, who conveyed the sympathy and condolences on behalf of His Majesty's government. His will and testament, which was addressed to Shoghi Effendi, was read 5 weeks after his ascension. Shoghi Effendi was in London when Abdu'l-Bahá passed away and sailed to Haifa after his recovery from that shocking news. Friends, by reading 3 excellent books, God Passes by Shoghi Effendi, Abdu'l-Bahá by the late hand of the cause, H.M. Balyuzi, and The Covenant of Baha'u'llah by Adib Tahirzadeh, you can easily recognize the limitation of this short presentation. Let us hope that this brief account of such a momentous life has excited your interest for deeper study of the life and ministry of Abdu'l-Bahá, the mystery of God.